Welcome to Healthy Paranoia, a show where engineers take off the tinfoil hats to talk about the practical aspects of security. We'll discuss the real vulnerabilities and threats to your organization because sometimes the biggest danger is your DBA, not a foreign APT. Hopefully we can demystify some of the FUD that comes with the territory. We talk to pen testers, threat analysts, hackers, frackers, and crackers, oh my! Today on the show, we have a very special guest. We'll be discussing the saga of Terry Childs, former network administrator for the city of San Francisco. With us, we have Gina Peraldi, Chief Security Officer of the Department of Technology for the City and County of San Francisco. I'll be your host, Mrs. Y, and VP of HR at Packet Pushers. As a special treat, we have two members of the Packet Pushers Executive Board with us, CEO and founder Greg Farrow, as well as COO and VP of Marketing Ethan Banks. Greg and Ethan, I really appreciate you taking the time away from your corporate duties to join Healthy Paranoia.
We have titles now. I didn't know that. It's awesome. I'm so happy to have it. Awesome. I was wondering what I do for Packet Pushers. Now I know. It's great.
Yeah. Well, we had an election, and actually that means me. And yeah. I decided that I could be a majority, and I gave you titles.
Excellent.
Thank you very much.
I'm feeling all important now. Mm. I'm feeling very self-important.
I'll scrape the next time I see you, Mr. Farrow. It seems only appropriate at this point.
I think we'll have to, you know, invest in executive bathrooms now.
Yeah. I know. And I think our IQ points just went down a little bit too, right?
Oh, yeah, good point.
What? I can go down? Well, I can't go down any further, surely.
But in all seriousness, I really appreciate, Gina, you taking the time to be with us today, especially because the big time zone variance for everyone involved in the podcast recording today.
Well, I'm happy to be here. And hello from sunny California.
Awesome.
So...
Well, so for those people, the listeners of Packet Pushers and Healthy Paranoia who've been living under a rock, maybe we should go over who Terry Childs is and what the background to the case. I thought it was just fascinating. It was I followed it pretty closely when it occurred, and I'm really excited to talk about it today because I think there's a potential there for some good discussion. So if you don't mind, can you give us some of the background?
Certainly. And I want to start off the podcast and saying that, you know, what I'm expressing here today, what we're talking about here today, does not necessarily reflect the views of the city and county of San Francisco. I want to be clear that I'm doing this separate from the city. Mr. Childs was a network engineer that we had employed in our Department of Technology, and we are the central IT organization for the city, so we provide all of the network, data center, and server systems for the city. And so Mr. Childs was the lead network engineer for a number of years, from 2003 up until his termination in 2008. And during that time, we had started to see, starting in about late 2007, some very unhealthy behavior, intimidation, coworkers complaining of issues and problems with Mr. Childs, uncomfortable run-ins, and email communications that were a little disturbing. We did some checks on what was going on, and it was found that Mr. Childs had a criminal background that he did not disclose when he was hired by the city. And through through a set of circumstances and issues that transpired, we came to confront Mr. Childs in July of 2008 regarding what was going on and to reassign him to another position within the department. And unbeknownst to us, although we had suspected it, but unbeknownst to us, Mr. Childs had created a sort of bunker for himself in the central data center and had locked the city out of its networks and had put himself over a period of months in a position to which he was the only one that had any access to the fiber network that the city was building.
And yeah, so this is called the FiberWAN system, correct?
The Fiber Wide Area Network, yes. We had the city of San Francisco is in an unusual position in that we own a lot of fiber conduit that it belongs to the city under the streets. And so we were able to build a carrier class fiber network leveraging that fiber. And it's a big cost savings for us. We get off of lease lines. We get off of, telco lines, and we're able to go into using our own networks. And so Mr. Childs was the lead engineer and was putting that system together. He, over time, was able to isolate himself to where he was the only one that knew about this system. And so anyway, we ended up going through a very long process of trying to get the passwords from Mr. Childs. He was incarcerated by the police department on a warrant. And when he was in jail, we had the big drama where the mayor went down.
Yeah, I read that. I didn't realize that it was, I guess I had missed that in my first reading of it, that he requested that the mayor come in person so that he could give him the passwords. Is that right?
That is correct. And here's the interesting piece of this. We had been working for about 7 days locked in a room at the data center. And again, I was intimately involved with this from the planning to the execution. And we had said, my boss and I had said from the very beginning to the HR folks, we need to be very careful because we suspect he may not give us the passwords. And they said nobody in their right mind would not give you the passwords.
Well, as I recall, I read in some of the articles that this is so funny because this is such an old school story. I'm sure that everybody on this recording has a similar but to a lesser degree type of story like this. But I understand that you actually had a personal run-in like right before he was terminated that it made you quite nervous, as I understand.
Well, yes and no. So some of that is press that was done by the city without my knowledge. I actually found out about that story. They had spun it that way several months ago, and Michelle, Ms. Y, you've actually met me. I had to edit that out. Yeah. And I am not a small shrinking violet.
No, you're not. You're a tough cookie.
I am from the Bayview area of San Francisco, born and raised, and I am about as street tough as they come, without have ever been in any kind of trouble, and. So when they spun it that way, it was kind of a funny story. I actually laughed about it when I first read it. And yes, Mr. Child is a very large gentleman. He is about 6'4", and probably at that time weighed about 250 to 280.
Oh, yeah, that's a big guy. Yeah.
Okay. He's a big dude.
So physically very, takes up a lot of space and... That brings a mental image with it as well of someone who really dominates the space.
He dominates the space, and he is a very angry body language and posture.
Right, okay. So he's aggressive personality as well?
Oh, yes.
Right. I get the impression that he must have been, right, to sort of get into that attitude of...
Yeah. He must have presented. People had run-ins with him before, and his own manager on the stand during the trial said that he was physically afraid of Terry, and Terry had threatened him. Mm. And when I had the run-in with him on June 20th of 2008, we were bringing in contractors to do an inventory of our data center. And I had to do some pre-scans the night before. And my boss, who was the chief operations officer, Richard Robinson, had said, hey, we're going to have Gina come down and do some pre-scans. We're doing an inventory. We could not get a clear count of the assets we had in our data center. And we were getting ready to move that data center to another facility.
Right.
And so we needed to be able to right-size that new facility.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we go down, and I come in with some equipment. I start to set up in the conference room. When I first showed up, Mr. Childs and two other coworkers, who I won't necessarily name, were standing there waiting for me. And there was a lot of layoffs going on and a lot of real organizational angst going on at that time.
All right.
So they were very paranoid. And I said, look, I'm here to do some scans. It's no big deal. The other two kind of left because it was about 4:30, 5 o'clock at night on a Friday night.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
They scatter. And I thought Mr. Childs left. I start to go into the conference room, set up my stuff. And there's like a little window to the conference room door. And yep. I can see him walking back and forth staring.
Oh, my God. Oh, man.
I was like, great. This is what I need. As the head of security, and I used to be, and let me step back here for a second. It's kind of interesting. I used to be the lead systems engineer and Terry's counterpart on the system side. So I had run-ins with him before. And I would have times where I would say, do I have good Terry today or do I have bad Terry today?
What is it? It's like, I don't know what it is between systems and networking people. It's like Game of Thrones or something, you know?
Oh, it's actually more like Lord of the Flies. You know, at some point, you know, it is. I mean, and I tell people, you know, the minute you take IT people on a whole, like mental level, because I used to be a network engineer and I went kind of a little bit of the reverse and went to systems when I got hired with the city. I really wasn't a systems engineer. My background was Unix and networking.
Right. You needed a break, huh? So you went to
I needed
systems.
A break. So I'm going to go to systems for a while and cruise. Not really. But so I knew more about networks than most people thought I did. But yeah, there's always kind of that rub between, you know, network and systems engineers. And I tell people, you know, IT departments are all the smart kids that you went to school with who always felt a little superior to everybody else in the class.
Because
now they're thrown in the same room together and trying to
find some order.
Oh, that's great. I've always seen it more like Planet of the Apes, and I think that I've always tried to figure out, like, I always thought that the networking engineers were the gorillas in Planet of the Apes, and that the chimpanzees were the systems people, and then I always thought that the orangutans were management.
Well, having gone from the chimps to the orangutans, like, so I had
metaphors so well developed that that's disturbing.
I've read this out.
You're looking up the difference between orangutans and chimps and trying to map them on personality types. You disturb me all the time, Michelle. Let's face it.
Well, let's be clear here. All three analogies have the same basic theme.
They do.
And they're rather Darwinian in their concepts.
Yes, they are.
So, what I always tell people that IT folks are really like you're taking the smartest kids in the class.
Yeah.
Who were probably usually not that well socially adjusted to begin with. Most of them were picked on and bullied when they were children.
Yeah. Can I put my hands down now?
Yeah.
No, see, I'm too big to have been bullied and picked on.
Oh, I was like target number one, but... You put them all together in the same room, and now you're saying, okay, survive, and get along, and be nice to each other. It's not going to work. So you end up with that dynamic.
Yeah, I mean, there is that. And, I mean, there was a time when we were, you know, masters of our own domains. So so few people knew what the hell we were doing, and that... and it's... I mean, look at the beardy Unix administrator and that archetype. That was propagated for many, many years, and they really got away with a lot back in the old days.
Well, and even in my old days, I mean, I've been in IT now for about 20 years. Hmm. And back when I started, you were the masters of your domain, and you were super smart, and everybody bowed down to you. And I got fed. I was fed very well by my coworkers to fix their computers, and no one ever wanted to make me mad or. And I always thought that was a really wrong way to do things, and that IT wasn't there for the sake of IT, that we're there to prevent or to prevent issues, but also to serve the business need.
Yeah, I agree, but I do have to admit that I remember that back in like 2006, a coworker told me much later, of course, that people would call his desk to find out what kind of mood I was in.
Yeah.
Before they called me. They were, how's Michelle today? Is she okay?
Okay, so that's disturbing, but I never had that problem because I never worked in end user space. I always worked for a reseller. So I did a decade working for resellers being hauled around from site to site, from customer to customer, who would variously treat me as some sort of demigod because I was brought in when the problems were so bad that the internal IT couldn't handle a particular thing, right?
So, you gotta remember, so you're actually the Magnificent Seven.
Well,
who are you? Are you Yul Brynner?
Boy, this conversation is going to devolve quickly, isn't it?
But I mean, back in the day, I mean, I remember when I can only imagine that this, you know, that Terry had this attitude that he was the smartest guy in the room, and therefore he was the only person who knew exactly what he did, and that over time that turned into some sort of a complex. I mean,
absolutely.
On one side, you want to admire the guy for taking such ownership of his responsibilities. And I'm sure he worked hard to do a pretty good job of it, I think. I don't think anybody's ever said that he was a bad engineer.
Well, yes and no. So, yes, he took ownership. The problem is that he took an ownership to an extremis.
Oh, yes.
That was a little disturbing. You know, at one point he tried to file copyrights on his design of the network. Yeah.
I think Radia Perlman and others might take exception to that.
They might, but at the same time, you know, that level of ownership.
Well, let me just have a go at that. One of the things when I'm employed, is I'm often employed as a consultant, and the first thing I read the contract for is in the copyright clause, because most employment contracts state that you hand over all copyright of any form of anything that you ever worked in. And I have to go back to them and say, I'm sorry, but most of the things that I do are copyrighted by somebody else. You know,
yes.
All of the, you know, and you can't copyright a design when it's stacked out from a template that was done from a vendor or you're using off-the-shelf technology. That seems to be, you know, an outrageous assertion.
Oh, we shouldn't have said this because now we're all going to get sued by Cisco.
No, we're not. Because they know about this. So, matter of fact, they were instrumental in helping us get that taken care of. But
oh, that's good.
But let's be clear, Mr. Childs is, and he may very well hear this podcast, so I wouldn't be surprised at all. Mr. Childs is a very good network engineer. He's a very smart man. I take nothing away from him on that. And in some ways, I sympathize with him in that he had a very tough life. He was raised in Kansas, in the Wichita area, and had a very tough life. His parents had various legal and addiction-related issues, from what I understand. I'm not saying that they do or they don't, but that's what my understanding is. And that as an 18-year-old, because he was an adult, Mr. Childs got himself into a lot of legal trouble and ended up spending 4 years in the Kansas State Penitentiary. So this is an individual who really had a mentality of, I had this horrible life, I've had this really hard time, and so by the time that we got to him in 2008, he had, you know, in some ways redeemed himself in his own mind, but he had also not disclosed that background to the city and was always fearful that that would be found out. And because we deal with public safety and we deal with law enforcement, you have to have you can't be a convicted felon. And he was.
What happened? Was the city of San Francisco just not doing background checks as a part of their regular hiring process?
He had actually lied on the application. And had not just, they ask you as part of your application. And it doesn't mean that's necessarily a bar from employment, but you have to be honest about it.
Right.
But we weren't doing background checks in 2003.
Yeah, a lot of people weren't.
It was hard to do. It was expensive to achieve.
Yes.
You know. So for somebody who's further down, sorry.
state government work that I did in roughly that time frame was only on a as-needs basis would we do a background check on someone. Yeah, mm-hmm. we would expect them to be honest about it as well, but we would only go out and do a background check if the specific area of state government they were going to be working in had some sort of unusual security requirements, like Department of Safety, which would deal with state police and FBI and these sorts of things, then it would could become an issue for someone.
It's gotten much more. I mean, I remember back in probably 2000, 2001, when I was employed in academia, they had hired somebody, and he then absconded with a lot of equipment, and they could never find him again. He had given a false address on his application. He had lied about a certification. I mean, these days, you couldn't even do that. I mean, it's pretty standard in even a non-government job to get a background check, because it's, you know, you have these companies who do them very quickly now. So it's the landscape has changed significantly from that respect.
That's right. Background checks in 2003 required a significant amount of paperwork, weeks of elapsed time because it was a paper search. It was largely unreliable. Whereas today, employers have embraced the opportunity to do checks via technology.
And this yes.
has stepped up to make that happen. I mean, and stories like this don't actually make this any less relevant, but... Mm.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's also the personality types. I mean, it's much more, the personalities that you guys mentioned. I once worked with a guy, a Unix engineer. He was an odd guy. He kept the information very close, you know, and did not share and did not document. And I came in, I remember coming into the server room one night, and he was singing to the servers.
And was it helping?
No. It didn't. Because I took over that box after him. It was a nightmare.
Well, and to be very clear, he probably thought it was.
Yeah, right. That's the scary part.
But, and let me be clear, in 2003, the city did take fingerprints. We did run him for a state background check within criminal history within the state of California.
Oh, okay. So
We did that. We did that pretty much across the board, and they were doing that when I was hired in 2005 as well. But what changed between the time Mr. Childs was hired in March of 2003 and, you know, really around May, June of 2007 is our department had started to engage more with law enforcement, and we were starting to bring those entities off of lease line and onto our networks. And therefore, according to the rules and the requirements of those systems, which are governed by the Department of Justice in the state of California, you have to pass a background check that covers all 50 states.
Wow.
Mm. Yes. And that kind of started really for us in 2006, because it was done for me when I first got there. Mm. And if you really want some fun, go spend an afternoon in Central Booking in San Francisco.
That's a whole new definition of fun, right?
Yes. That's where they send you. Yeah. And they said I was the only person that ever smiled for the mugshot. Where am I going to go, right? So, some things changed that made a difference, and he had to be backgrounded. And my understanding, and again, this is my understanding of accounts that were told to me by others, is he presented himself for background in 2006. The police department took one look at his paperwork, said he won't pass. He can work on our networks escorted. And they, as the holder of the Klutz connection, are responsible for that, that action. But they never notified the department HR, that there was an issue. Subsequently, talking to the sheriff's deputies at the sheriff's department, we do have one in San Francisco, the sheriff's department said, when we took him on a tour of the jail to do some work for us, before we put in our Klutz connection, we noticed that he had some odd behavior in the jail. And when we went to walk him through, we lined the prisoners up, and he lined up with them. And stood automatically in the same manner.
That's like something out of a movie script. Wow.
Yeah, really. I mean, they were like, whoa, why would that guy do that? So they ran him and found out that he had a criminal background. His manager knew of some of the background and some of the issues and kept it to himself.
Okay.
And yeah, that's another issue for us.
Wow.
So by the time we get to 2008, there are enough people that know of the background but haven't told anybody. And so when we start to investigate, we go to the city attorney's office because we had started to become very suspicious about his behavior. And the thing that really highlighted it was the police department was putting in a gunshot location system in certain areas of the city, the Bayview being one of them where I grew up. And they wanted to put it on the fiber network, and Terry said no.
What? Wait a second. He just said no?
No. We actually had to go build. It was so bad. We had to go build a network around him. We had to go around him.
Oh, my God.
And build a whole separate network aside from him for that particular product because he said no.
And why wouldn't that have just been a firing offense at that point?
Because it's government employment.
That difficult to get rid of him under the terms of union contract or whatever.
Correct.
It was. Yeah.
So, and his boss was starting to express fear of him. We found out later from Cisco that about that time period, his manager, Herb Tong, called Cisco and said, "What do? I think I'm locked out of my networks." And that he had confronted Terry in February of 2007 and said, "I need the passwords." And Terry said, "No, it's my network. I copyrighted it. Get out of here."
Oh my God.
Now, and
this is like a bad Lifetime movie, isn't it?
It really is. And so, in defense of Herb, Herb is not a very big man.
Yeah.
Herb is, you know, Mr. Tong is not a very large physical presence. He's a very quiet gentleman. He's very, very smart, but he's very, very quiet. And I could see where Terry intimidated and scared him.
Wow, this is just like spiraling. It's just spiraling.
So you start to get this spiral thing going on. So when I got hired our chief operations officer, I had gotten my CISSP and he put out the position for the security manager and CSO. He asked me to apply for it and I did and I got the position. So by the time I walked into the position in March, we had a whole firestorm going on. So in November of 2007.
And you still took the position?
I didn't know.
Oh, no. Oh, you poor
thing. I kind of knew, but I kind of didn't. So they didn't really tell me. But that's okay. That was okay. So, again, I'm not a shrinking violet, so that probably wouldn't have stopped me anyway.
Yeah.
Long story short is we hired an investigator through our human resources who went out to investigate Mr. Child's background. Unbeknownst to us that the human resource manager that was engaged to hire the investigator, that gentleman was also on friendly terms with Mr. Child's and had disclosed to him what was going on.
Oh, my God. This just gets worse and worse.
It's going to get worse. Stick with the story. Follow the bouncing ball because this is great. So now we've got this leak. We didn't know. So it's taken like 5 months to investigate the background. In the meantime, a couple of us find this website called Casper, K-A-S-P-E-R, for the state of Kansas. And just to be, because we'd kind of heard that he had a background that was shady, and that he changed jobs a lot and blah, 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 blah. We go and find out that he's listed on that database as being incarcerated in the state of Kansas. And we find out what the offenses are. It's on the internet.
Wow. Okay. Wow.
Okay. So now we've got a problem. So starting...
Now we've got a problem? Yeah, you do. I mean, haven't actioned it before now and, you know...
Wow. So you've got a bunch of issues that come up. But I think the thing to look at is the organization as a whole. Yeah. And between 2005 and 2010, our department was downsized several times due to budget cuts and budget issues. The state of California was kept cutting its pay to the city. The city then had to cut positions. We were furloughed. And our department went from about 350 people down to about 200 people.
Wow. Right.
And so... At the same time that we've got the Terry Childs incident, we also have approximately 20 folks in our department who are disgruntled and being laid off.
Holy God.
Yeah. No, it was fun.
Wow.
So they were noticed of their layoff at the end of June, their walkout date was August. The day that they would be walking out of the department was August 22nd of 2008. In between that layoff notice and the date that they're walking out the door, Terry Childs happens on July 8th. That confrontation occurs. He is arrested on the 13th. There was a five-day period where the police were tailing him. He took off to he eluded police, the police tail, and took off to Nevada. We don't know what happened in Nevada, but we do know that drives and data from the city are still missing to this day. And he comes back from Nevada, and the police get him in his driveway and arrest him under a search, under a warrant. They search his home. They find all sorts of information and stuff from the city. He is then put in jail on a $5 million bond, and which is the largest.
$5 million.
That's a huge number.
It was the largest bond ever in the city of San Francisco at the time. There's been one marked. No, I'm not kidding.
Wow.
And I'll explain why that bond was put in place. I can't say enough, though, about the DA that tried this case. He was absolutely relentless in his pursuit.
This is the worst possible case scenario for something like this. I mean, I think it's important to note here that, we might have managers and CISOs and executive people who happen to listen to this podcast, and if they hear this story and the details, it's like a lot of it is what not to do and the worst case scenario of something that could happen on your network.
Absolutely. And I think this goes to, you know, when you're doing layoffs and when you're managing, I mean, if you stick, you know, this was a case, if you asked me 4 years ago what my opinion of the case was when Mr. Childs was convicted, which is probably one of the biggest moments of relief of my life, when they came back with that guilty verdict, to what it is today, you know, 5 years out or 4 years out from the conviction, my perspective is very different.
How so?
Well, because there are things that happen in the heat of the battle. I mean, that's a very, let me be clear. These kinds of cases, because it happened in a public sector employment situation, are public. If this had been private sector, and these cases do happen in private sector, more often than not, they would have paid Mr. Childs a large sum of money to go away. He would have given the passwords, and everybody would have gone about their business very quietly. And that would have been the end of it. In the public sector, we can't do that. And the district attorney's office was involved, the mayor's office was involved, and it becomes very public very quickly, and it becomes kind of a cautionary tale. I think the cautionary tale is that we rely so much on technology to do our jobs day in and day out that it's almost like we don't really realize how much we're reliant. And the people that make the technology work need to be properly trained, properly invested in, properly managed. But also, had you had more people in our department that did networks, if you were paying, I mean, let's face it, Mr. Childs made substantially less money than network engineers of his credentials did in private employment.
But that might have been in part because of his background. You know, he was, had a difficult upbringing, and then knew that his background was that he may not be able to work for other people. Where would he go?
He had worked for several other companies before coming to us.
Right.
But his length of tenure was really never longer than 18 months.
Yeah.
Given the personality, I'm going to guess that either they found out his background or he upset somebody, and away he went.
Yeah. And then they found out about his background.
Then they found out about it.
I mean, I spent plenty of time working for dysfunctional companies.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a career, there's companies who, you know, that have had people like this, but he seems to have taken it to all forms of extremes.
Yeah.
I think he did, and I think I think he felt that he was justified, that the management was bad, that he had put himself in a very victimized position. I also think that the case probably would have, there were a couple turning points where I think that the case might have settled much more quietly and with less fanfare than it did, and probably without as much publicity as it did. And a couple of those points are when Mr. Child was first incarcerated, the DA's office, DA Kamala Harris, who's now our state attorney general, held a press conference, which really at the time was kind of a rub to the mayor's office, but they held a press conference to talk about the case when nobody really knew what was going on.
That probably caused a lot of things to spiral.
It caused a lot of things to spiral. And you have to understand that Mr. Childs is very manipulative. To the external clients, except with the exception of a few, he was very nice, very kind, very responsive, took care of them. Internally, he was very, you know, brusque, demeaning, condescending, and somewhat threatening to his coworkers. So the dynamics were very different. So the external clients were very mad at us for the actions and what was going on. We also had a group of disgruntled employees who were being laid off, who were sympathetic to Terry Childs, who then went out and, you know, gave fed certain folks in the computer news space information about what was going on. And it was very slanted in favor of Mr. Childs because it was an ongoing investigation, because HR was involved, because the city attorneys were involved. We could not counteract or do any kind of publicity or interviews that would give the other side of the story.
Right, because, I mean, who was allowed to talk from the organization? No one, right?
No.
Right.
No one. So you had to let it be what it was going to be. And you know, I love the people that blogged under my name. People were going on the internet and blogging or comments saying that they were Regina Peraldi, and they weren't. And they had enough inside detail about the case to, you know, they were obviously city employees or people that knew Mr. Childs or knew somebody in the city. So there were folks that would do those kinds of things. You know, so there was a lot of things that were being fed to defense attorneys and a lot of things that were going on that we couldn't stop because it's public employment. And I think the important thing to realize, too, is, you know, our networks had public safety on there. Had those networks gone down, and they were very close to going down, the level that we could, the closeness that we got to tipping that system and having those networks wipe themselves, having the devices wipe themselves, was ours.
Wow.
At one point. So had those gone down, we would have lost the ability to dispatch the public safety, police, fire, sheriff, ambulance would have been lost for a substantive amount of time. And that's why the bail was so high.
Wow. So what has changed? So there was a lot of things that sort of...
Absolutely.
That sort of allow this to happen. And what has the city of San Francisco done to make sure that this kind of incident can't happen in the future?
Well, I think a couple of things that are most significant is, you know, aside from the obvious, we Cisco came in, and I can't say enough of nice things about them as a vendor. They came in and they without question helped us, and did so very much at no charge to the city. They helped us re-architect and rebuild the network. They testified. They helped the DA build the case. They were fabulous. So those are the obvious things, right? We did the conviction, and we re-architected the network. We moved our data center. The things that we've done that are less obvious, everyone that gets hired in our department, it's a condition of employment that they pass the background check. And we state that in the interviews. And we tell folks in interviews, if you have any open warrants, don't accept the job, because it'll be a one-way trip down to the sheriff's department. So that's been an important change for us. We have, as a city, started, and again, government moves very slow. So we have created a baseline set of policies that are vetted by a security working group. And that working group is attached to our main governance body, which is the Committee on Information Technology. And that's actually a very important thing. You know, we had started to create and have had different fits and starts at creating a governance body for IT in the city. And there's been a lot of pushback because people don't want their fiefdoms interrupted.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Exactly.
It's a hard thing to
break
down.
What is it with what? Now, that really gets me, right? When people get on about a fiefdom, right? This is my network. This is my server. This is my system. This is... It's not yours. It's just a bunch of crap that's welded together that you've invested a lot of time and energy in,
that's right.
It's only a matter of time until it's obsolete and it gets ditched anyway. You don't own it.
I know, but it's the nature of it's the human mind identifies, especially, I think, the American male tends to, especially in a lot of ways, identify with his job. And it's
all right. I'm gonna saddle up on my political hobby horse here and say it's the lack of healthcare in America that causes it, right? Because if you lose your job, you lose your healthcare, right? And
fair
people
enough.
Really worry about that,
right?
And if you lose your income, that's one thing. But if you lose your healthcare and you lose your income and you get sick, there's no way out of that death spiral.
But
that's a poverty trap that you can't recover from, and a lot of people live in permanent fear of being sick and poor. And at least by living in the UK in a lovely communist fascist society by American standards, I get the NHS, right? So even if I was completely unemployed and was ill, at least my family could get medical health care, and world-class quality.
Well, I hate to say this. This is a misnomer. For those of you that don't live in the United States, that's not necessarily true. Because if you're unemployed in the United States and you have children, you can get health care through the Medicaid system and the Medicaid in California. We call it Medi-Cal. You do get coverage, and in some cases, it's at no cost to you. And you would actually sometimes get better health care using that coverage than you do using private health insurance.
But it is a problem. I mean, I think Greg has a point in terms of, it's the COBRA extensions have helped, but if you've ever paid COBRA, I mean, it's a big big chunk of change, especially if you have dependents. But I think another thing is that there's been a shift, actually, I think, in the last, 5 or 6 years about what an engineer's role is in an organization. It used to be that you were more almost like a plumber, and your any personality quirks just seem to be part of the gig, right? And now you're considered more of a professional, and there are expectations that you document your work, you write, you do designs and proposals, and it's what I've seen is that the expectations are very different. You know, you had these kinds of this island of misfit toys kind of acceptance of the eccentricities, where there seems to be less of that now. Do you guys think that's fair?
I think that's fair. I think there is less of that. I think you still get Gina, like you were describing early on, the collection of people that were the misfits growing up all seemed to end up in IT, and now we're all supposed to play well together now. There is some of that, but I think it has gone away to a degree, and there's more an element of expectation of professionalism and getting along with the business and not being allowed to sit in the corner and just do your own thing.
Now they're all in security.
I do tell you that the most effective personalities I come across in IT today are still in security. But, I mean, in the old days when business used to just treat us like we were some sort of leper, I used to be definitely treated like that at a lot of places where the tech, that guy who knows how to make don't upset him, just whatever it is, just let him get it done, because what he's doing, he might be casting spells and raising demons out the floor for all we understand. Whatever you do, don't upset him because we need him to do it, right? And that barrier has long since collapsed in terms of networking, because nowadays, as I'll get on my SDN unicorn now and ride that around, because SDN and virtualization and servers and applications are all getting glommed into one team. So instead of IT infrastructure being 15 different disciplines, over there's the Apache guy, and that's the Unix guy, and that's the Linux guy, and that's the network guy, and that's the Windows guy, and that's the data center guy. They're all very much now running as a single unit. And as Gina says, she's gone from having 800 people in a team to 200 people. As those teams get smaller and smaller in IT, they're becoming much more multidisciplinary, and we rub up much more against the business people, and there's no more, what we do is no longer, raising demons from the dark side of the spirit veil. It's just doing stuff with computers,
The only people who do the demon raising now are the they're in security. That's
well, that's
we do
the fun
that.
Of it. I mean, isn't that the fun of it, though? You know, what are the security people doing? Ooh, we need special computers so we can look at you. And let me tell you, you want to freak somebody out, encase their machine and get the stuff back that they deleted. just give them a diaper and say, watch this. Guarantee they will have a fit. So, but I think we've changed the expectation. But what we haven't done is we haven't facilitated the adjustment.
You mean for the personalities? You're saying that we haven't helped onboard some of these engineers into human society?
Correct.
Okay.
So let me give you an example. So if you've ever had, many of us go to the doctor and we think they're very smart and they went to medical school. But if you've ever actually spent time with anyone who's a physician or a psychologist or anyone who is of that profession outside of their work, you start to realize that there's only so much space. If your brain's like a hard disk, right? And it's only so much space in your brain. And that at some point, they started to dump off things like common sense, personality, communication skills, and empathy to take on more medical information.
Actually, Dan Goleman, who's written all the books on emotional intelligence and social intelligence, they've done tests on that, and they actually say that that's true. The more
yes.
ingrained and more refined you get in a certain profession and the higher level that you reach, there's a trade-off. There actually is, in that you lose
yes.
human interrelational skills.
And I think
I resemble that remark. I chose computers so I didn't have to talk to people. What are you talking about? I regard most humans as defective. Let's face it. Who wants to talk to people all day? I'd much rather talk to a headset or a computer. At least they'll get a rational answer.
I'm laughing because this is all too true.
It is true.
I'm not laughing because it's like, oh, yeah, I know a guy like that. I'm thinking, oh, that's me. Yeah.
Well, what's so funny is that Ethan then it consistently talks about, you know, even though Ethan's sort of like the smooth wrapper around the pack of pushers realm, right? You know, he's got this sort of Bing Crosby kind of persona going on, and you know, he's very personable, but it's, you know, then he tells me secretly, I have to interact with people now.
Got time to go deal with humans. Here we go.
Well, yeah. I have to say, honestly, Ethan, I'm the same way, and so I'm this introverted kind of bookish personality type that on the weekends, my other half tells me all the time, are you going to speak today?
Yeah.
And
why?
And the answer is rather not, or why?
Yeah.
And you know, I mean, my fun time is for me to go out and ride my bike by myself and reboot my brain, as I say. So, I think
I hike. I go up into the mountains and reboot, so to speak.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm good with people to a point, and then I'm just kind of out of gas. And it's like I'm, enough. I need some time by myself to recharge and all that. It's exhausting after a bit dealing with folks.
I think it maybe managers need to understand that about us. I mean, I think all of us on this call have learned coping mechanisms, right? We've gained strategies. But I think management then has to sort of understand that, okay, that's a place of stress for them, that actually tires them. And maybe they won't make us go to as many meetings. Don't know.
Well, I think that there's a point where we turn it on and we turn it off consciously versus other people who are more extroverted and more into the social aspects of it. Mm-hmm. But I think we as a business unit, and I do look at IT as a business unit, really need the business to come to us and start to work with us and our staff about how to be more engaged socially and how to communicate and why, you know, calling someone a moron is a really bad idea.
Yeah, actually, that's when you read, and I'm going to bring up Dan Goleman again, sorry, but when you read his books, he talks about communications being one of the skills that is not developed at pretty much after you leave high school. And that's a shame because we're so heavily reliant on it, and we really do need to be developing it. And business, especially IT, they need to understand that you can't just send somebody to some professional development course once every couple of years and expect that that's going to feed your organization interrelationally.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, okay, so for those people in the audience, which is probably about 75% of you, I reckon, who are listening to this, there's a really, really good book I'm going to recommend. This is the first and last time you'll ever hear me recommend a textbook. It's called The Introvert Advantage by Marty Olson Laney.
Staring at it on my shelf right now. It is a go, Greg. It's great. Yes.
Yeah. How to Thrive in an Extrovert World. And it literally talks about how being an introvert, how the big difference, and the book basically revolves, in my opinion, around just one key concept. If you're an extrovert and you go out and meet people, then the more people you meet, the more energy you get, and the more excited you become, and the more outgoing, and the more meetings you go to, the more meetings you want to attend, and the more energy you can generate to go on. But 25% of the population is an introvert, and every person you talk to, every conversation you have wears you down, and you need to, at some point, you get worn down to the point where your batteries are discharged, and you need to go away and find a corner and have some quiet time, or just a peaceful time to recharge a bit, and then you can come back and spend more time grinding up against people. I am firmly in the introvert class, and if you can master that and realize that you cannot attend 8 hours of meetings back to back because your personality type just doesn't support it, you will probably find that your career picks up astonishingly.
I absolutely agree with that, and I'm one of those folks that does not do well with back to back meetings and needs my time. But I think that there is a certain amount of training and recognition and kind of cultural reinforcement in the organization that helps people that are like me, that are that Myers-Briggs INTJ personality type, really flourish and do really well. And I think sometimes that's missing in the training for IT staff and the professional development. We spend so much time on the technical, we don't spend enough time on the intrapersonal and the soft skills.
Agreed. I believe that as well. And I talk about that a lot in some of my work, but it's, you know, it's hard to convince people because they really just want to go play with some hardware. And maybe that's where, you know, joining professional organizations like a local hacker group or a makerspace or a networking group, at least you're interacting with other human beings, but under the guise of understanding new technology. So that's where I think that can really benefit people as well, trying to get out of the books and the labs.
So I'm going to disagree with you, Michelle, just to, you know, not that I ever disagree with you, so maybe this is the first time ever.
And no, please note the sarcasm in Mr. Farrow's voice.
There's one thing, one of the problems that I have a friend who's a doctor, and one of the biggest problems that we talk about is that he is actually a scientist. But the problem is that people actually expect him to be a sociologist or a psychologist and to be able to communicate. But what they really want him to do is to say, hold out this thing and go, yes, your arm is broken. We need to slice it up into chunks and put it back together. That's a science job. But people want to get this lovely skin of warm feeling and bedside manner. And I think that what we actually need is we need our managers, we need our leadership and our team functioning to understand that there is a time when you're engaging somebody who has a certain sort of mind that delivers a certain sort of job, and they need to think like we do. And now that doesn't obviate our responsibility to be able to communicate effectively back to them, but here's what I need. I need my managers to understand my problems and my challenges. I find it extremely difficult to work for companies that I have done in the past where the manager goes, no, I don't want to hear about that. Just tell me what it's going to do. And I'm sitting there looking at this guy going, well, you know what? I'm going to treat you like that. Because if you can't take an interest in the – just get a skin of what my job requires and some of the details. You need to understand what I'm doing. So if you're not going to understand what I'm doing, why would I be bothered to be interested in you? There's no reciprocation here.
I think we're actually not in disagreement. I think we're trying – I think it's the point is to find a middle ground where we understand that it's – you know, the limbic system's an open loop, and we are emotional beings, and that's going to have an impact. But we need to understand each other. We need to understand that the engineer, the nerd, the geek is going to be more introverted. They're going to feel stress in different ways. I mean, it's we've got to understand each other and have empathy. And I think, am I freaking you guys out? I'm talking about emotions and feelings. Are you guys okay with this?
I need a hug. Please hug me, someone.
Ah, But yeah, so I think we're in agreement. It's just about finding that middle ground and understanding each other. And I don't see the problem is that what happens is Gina's right. We spend so much time on technical training that we just and then it gets to a boiling point and everything just melts down and we're surprised. Like, well, how did we get to this point?
A lot of it's just because, I mean, I've worked with enough people over time now, enough managers and executives over time to find that it's when I'm being misunderstood. And the hardest part for me is when I'm being deliberately misunderstood. When the executive sits across from the table and says, I don't need to know that technical stuff. Just go and make it happen and make it match my business. And I go, well, what does your business want? And he waffles off about money and revenue, but I can't turn that into technology. And I say to you, well, you'll have to help me turn that into technology. And that's that misunderstanding that comes in. Now, and this is part, just to bring this full circle around, I mean, you know, I look at what happened to Terry Childs. The guy, you know, clearly has some problems. But there was a time when we were just left alone and we weren't expected to understand or to communicate effectively. We were just left in a corner to do whatever it is that we needed to do. And then in the last decade, I've had to learn how to communicate and to spell money and project planning and, you know, work out, you know, how to be useful to the business. But I'm still faced with executives who refuse to learn computers or to type or to use keyboards or, you know, getting their iPad for the first time ever. And they're like, wow, this is a revolution, man.
Well, and I think to your point, there's a reason why the SANS securing the human training modules include one for senior managers.
That's a good point, yeah.
To senior management. I think you have to look at, you know, we as a business culture, and I say this kind of in an American European sense, we promote people based on technical skills and not the actual acumen to be a manager.
Yeah, that's always bothered me. Like, you'll get somebody who has reached the height of promotion in terms of he's a senior network engineer and he wants more money, and so he goes, huh, I guess I should go into management. And
right. We'll take our best technologists and turn them into communicators. Perfect.
And it never works out well, you know.
And I think that describes, honestly, that describes Mr. Childs' boss. You took somebody who was technically very smart and they made him a manager, and he managed for a very long time, I think 20, he was with the city for 35 years, managed for about 25 of it, but he really would have been better off as a network architect and somebody more in the background, and probably happier too.
So you think that's one of the major problems too, is that it's not just what the expectations are in terms from engineers, in terms of documentation, playing nice with others, but also maybe in IT, one of the ways to address this type of security issue is having managers who actually know how to manage.
Correct. And giving them the tools and making that expectation. And I think when you do promote people, that, I mean, there is the Peter principle, right? You eventually will be promoted to the point of utter incompetence. When you start to see the Peter principle is personified in that individual, then I think you need to take steps to maybe to redirect them into a much more comfortable position through training and through opportunity. Or to coach them to say, you know, maybe this isn't for you. It's okay that you go back to being this. And I, you know, so I think there's a little bit of we promote people based on technical competence and not acumen and emotional intelligence.
Right. I agree with that. So where do you think you guys are right now in terms of security? I don't want you to give anything away to the hacker listeners, but because they're taking
notes. Let me take off my pith helmet. We are now in a life cycle where we are testing the network with our city auditor's office regularly, and so we have it is no small feat to us given our proximity to Oakland and some of the issues around Anonymous and some of the hacker groups. It is no small feat to me that we have not been a target, we have not been breached is a matter of concern for me because we haven't been concerns me, but we are far better off in our posture than we were 5 years ago. Security is a primary factor in the consideration of funding all IT projects.
Is it built into the architecture lifecycle? I mean, do you have an ESA? Yes. Oh, that's great.
We do build it into our architecture lifecycle. We are creating right now, our goal over the next year is to take all of our back-end systems that we have installed since the 2008 incident and put it into a single pane of glass dashboarding and reporting tool for us to start to have more correlation and more visibility into the networks and to what is going on. One of the things we can tell you today is the traffic coming into our network and the traffic going out of our network. We didn't have that capability in 2008. We can tell you, we can throttle that traffic. We can track that traffic. We can map it. We can tell you where in the world it is coming from. We can tell you every website and web address that every city employee on our networks is going to. And we're filtering and monitoring that content much more closely than we did. So those are things that we are doing. We're also engaging, again, engaging in creating a specific set of policies and procedures around IT. And we've created a security working group where all of the ISOs from all the different departments in the city, police, fire, sheriff, health, controllers, and even down to the library, get together once a month and have a very constructive conversation around what we're doing in our organizations around security, where we can help each other, and what enterprise-wide solutions do we want to put in place to manage security much more effectively.
So then you're breaking down the idea of silos much more, and you're trying to cooperate and collaborate. That's great.
Yeah, and it's really kind of nice when, the ISO at the airport calls me and says, hey, I need your advice. What should I do about X? Or when we're testing some of our new, monitoring software, hey, we call human services and we call the ISO over there and we say, hey, we're testing this new stuff. Do you want to work with us on it? And people before didn't even know who each other's names, now are coming up and hanging out with my security team and working on stuff together and being much more collaborative. There's been a change in the culture that way.
Wow, that must have been hard to achieve. I think that's hard in any organization, but that's laudable that how hard did you have to work to get to that point?
I have to say, this is where I should send Mr. Child a muffin basket. because it's really seizing the opportunity of not letting that incident go wasted. And saying, we had this incident. And all I have to say to folks is, if you don't want another Terry Childs, this is what we need to do. Because people tend to stay in government employment for long periods of time, so they have the memory of the pain and the embarrassment of that incident. And our staff has the memory and the pain and the embarrassment of being associated with that incident. So, because that's really fresh in people's minds, and will be probably 10 years from now,
Don't
let that incident go unwasted.
Institutional memory is a fine thing, and 2020 hindsight.
Yes, but I think even at the top levels, you can go into the folks at the mayor's office and say, we're doing this because we don't want another Terry Childs. We don't want to be hacked like the folks in Oakland were with Anonymous. We respect their skill set. We respect what they can do to us. We want to be we want to minimize that risk to an acceptable level, which is really your job in security. Then you get a lot more traction, and you sound reasonable when you say these things because they've experienced it.
I mean, that's one of the reasons why I wanted to have this show. I find it interesting. One of the things that bothers me about security a lot of times as an industry is that they want to spend a lot of time talking about breaking, about what's broken, how to, malware analysis, reverse engineering, and that's fine, and it's actually really good work. However, the stuff that's not so sexy, like business continuity, disaster recovery, the availability part of the CIA triad. I mean, that, keeping the organization up and safe from harm is, I think, probably our most important activity. And it sounds like that you've worked on that the city of San Francisco has tried to recapture that.
Correct. And I want to say, you can put all the technology, I mean, you go into RSA and yeah. Folks have been there. You know, it's great to get the t-shirts, and it's great to see the wonderful models that they hire to can't answer any of your questions.
We actually, No, it's not. It's really not that interesting. Come on, let's
try. It's all this really cool technology that has no context. And I think you have to create a program that goes out and starts to educate the end user, that educates them on what their role and responsibility is, educates them on what you can and cannot do, and educates them on how to use their stuff at home, I think is really, really important.
And that doesn't mean one of the cheap, easy newsletters that you send out from your security department once a month, or making them watch that compliance-derived video that they can click through. You know, well, no, it tracks you now, and it makes sure, and even has little questions, and they make sure that you have to go through it. So, yeah. Yes.
And I think an important thing that we can do, as much as IT people, marketing people, and salespeople make us crazy, is one of the things that we're doing, we're starting to launch our city. We're finally at the point where we can now launch a citywide training program. And one of the things that we're looking to do is bring in a marketing firm. Because we're not good marketers. We're terrible at it. We're IT people. We're propeller heads. Our propellers start to spin, and it makes sense to us. It doesn't make sense to my... 7-year-old mother doesn't get it.
And I have there are ways to do that which don't involve marketing firms, by the way. And
I know, but it's easier for me.
Yeah, I know, that's true.
Yes, well, and it's got a big population. I mean, you know,
27,000 endpoints, 27,000 bodies. Yeah. That we're going to be educating is a large number of people, and so you have to look at your demographic. And, you know, so, you know, and not to say that that's a good or a bad thing, but I think you can have all the technology in the world. If your program does not include the people component and the process component, your technology is useless because there's no context to it. It's just cool tools that your little propeller gets to spin while you're playing with.
Well, it sounds like we've covered everything, and I definitely have gotten a lot out of this discussion. I don't know about Ethan and Greg and Gina, but I really think the listeners will enjoy this discussion immensely.
Absolutely, and it was a thank you for having me. It was a pleasure to be here.
So, thanks for listening, and hope you can follow us on Twitter at Packet Pushers, join the LinkedIn group, or even hang out with our listeners on IRC at Freenode. Visit packetpushers.net to read blogs by the growing Packet Pushers community, subscribe to our RSS feeds, and donate to the show. Please, Greg and Ethan need some new firewalls to make fun of. Email your comments or questions about the show to packetpushers@gmail.com or healthyparanoia@packetpushers.net. And remember, it's healthy paranoia, because sometimes they really are out to get you.